WRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, this is Amanda Marshall, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Bob lived at a time in the 40s in a heteronormative culture, right? But it was a heteronormative culture that was insisting that being a homosexual was sinful.
Today on Rainbow Country, the story of Bob. That and more next. So stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gordep of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. As always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. Well, thanks to you, tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately, listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into an award-winning, nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So today, the story of Bob, a book that tells the true life story of Reverend Robert W. Wood, a story of courage, identity, social justice from the greatest generation, a World War II veteran and an ordained Christian minister. And here to talk about his book, The Story of Bob, is the book's author, an ordained pastor in his own right, Stephen C. Law. We'll find out about the story of Bob and so much more. Plus, in Hour 2, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, British author Adam Smith reads from his book, Deep Smith, A History of Paupers and Queer Futures. By the way, the reading is accompanied by the parody song, Just a Quick Sniff of Paupers, from drag duo Cookie and Kashida.
When I was just a lad, I learned that anal sex was bad. The church said it was a dirty, rotten sin. But then I learned from other guys that no matter what the size, there's a simple trick to help you take that tick. Just a quick sniff of poppers helps the penis slide right in. The penis slides right in, you can take it with a grin. Just a quick sniff of poppers helps the penis slide right in the most delightful way.
In the winter of 1866, actually, while a medical student in Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, Brunton met a patient called William H. This young man was only 26, but already had trained as a blacksmith. and then switched to tollkeeper. His first job may have required too much exertion for him to continue because Brunton's notes reveal that William suffered from heart trouble. When Brunton met him, William had recently been hit by a dull, heavy pain about the left nipple every 3 days or so, lasting for at least half an hour. The pain had come on after years of infrequent attacks ever since he'd suffered from rheumatism as a child. After a 3-week hospital stay earlier in the spring, William was back just before Christmas. Doctors gave him aconite, which slows the heart rate, and digitalis. When neither worked, Brunton gave him brandy. The strong stuff didn't help either, so there was only one thing for it. The experiment was not a stab in the dark. Brunton acted in a way that was consistent with his wishes to take basic research from the lab to the bedside, and only with a decent understanding of the actual effect in the body. He had read the work of another scientist, Richardson, that amyl nitrite dilated blood vessels, and had even discussed the effect with his colleague in Edinburgh, Arthur Gamgee, who had made some unpublished measurements of this effect. Brunton obtained some amyl nitrite from Gamgee, who made it for him, and consent for an experiment from his supervising physician. And this is how Brunton came to give his patient William amyl nitrite. On March the 12th, 1867, Brunton observed, "The pain came on as usual at 3 a.m. A few drops of nitrite of amyl were put on a towel and inhaled by the patient. The primary effect noticed was a suffusion of the face, and the patient felt a glow over his face and chest. The pain disappeared almost simultaneously with the occurrence of these phenomena, but returned in 3 minutes. He then inhaled 5 drops more. The pain again disappeared and did not return."
I met this guy once in a bar who took me outside to his car. He spread my cheeks and tried to ram it in. I screamed, "No, it's too big." He said, "Take it all, you pig." Then he shoved this small brown bottle up my nose. And girl, I gotta tell you something. That quick snip of puppers let the penis slide right in. The penis slide right in.
Now I can take it with a grin.
Just a quick snip of puppers let the penis slide right in. In the most delightful way.
Good queer performers push their audiences forward into the future they desire. A good performance is utopia, for a moment. In the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, all of these potential utopias were whirled away when the police stormed in. Performances interrupted, orgasms foregone, connections broken. The police brought their alternative performance. The police did not just want to stop what was happening, they wanted to make their own utopia for a moment. They pulled on their costumes and they put themselves to work on embodying authority, power, intimidation. As individual officers, people with homes and hobbies, they had been moved by some newspaper stories about a deadly sex craze and by others that spoke of a horrible illness killing men who had sex with each other. They heard the words of politicians who spoke about preserving families and protecting children. As individuals, they may even have wanted no more gay or queer people. As an organized group of individuals, each wanting to belong to something bigger than they were, police officers were grabbed by the idea of cutting the number of queer venues. All we have is the records of their group performance, the way they stopped gay and queer people. They arrested our futures, at least for a night or two. The story of these raids is a story from the past, but it is about how we live in the present, creating a future. In every moment we are performing, making choices about the future we want to build for ourselves and others. We can be inspired by other people who are better than us at articulating a future, but it is not some distant, formless thing. How we are living now is always creating a future, whether we like it or not. Whether or not we are trying, we are performing a future. As a genderqueer dancer stretches the limbs they have, they bring us into their utopia for a moment.
Wow, this stuff is amazing!
Yeah, let me try some. I've never done it before.
Wow, this is hot.
Oh, shit.
Hey, Cookie, let's put something in my ass and see if it works.
I just dropped the whole thing on the carpet. Here, bend over. Let me try this chair.
Oh, my God, I can't even feel anything.
Oh, shit, the whole thing fits.
Wow, the room is spinning right now. These are great, but you know what? You can't use them if you're taking Viagra.
Why?
Well, because you'll die.
Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Wow, this stuff is amazing. So this goes out to all the guys who are too concerned with size. It really doesn't matter anymore. As you watch his manhood grow, shove that bottle up your nose.
relax,
relax
your hole,
your hole,
and slide down on that pole.
Just a quick sniff of bubbles, help the penis slide right in, the penis slide right in. You can take it with a grin. Just a quick sniff of bubbles, help the penis slide right in.
In the most delightful,
making it not frightful.
Up next, the story of Bob.
Hi, I'm Syeda Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Seven weeks into training, I was assigned a message to deliver across camp. I walked alone through a section of camp where I hadn't been before and passed an open fenced-in area approximately 50 feet square. Guards posted at each corner atop four 10-foot-high observation towers kept watch. Barbed wire surrounded the area. Without slowing down, I glanced through the barbed wire. Men stood in the open area, whites and blacks together. I looked again and noticed Q written on the backs of three of the men. Queer flashed in my mind like a neon light over a roadside diner flashing eat. It was like an electric shock. Men like me had been caught. After I delivered the message, I retraced my steps outside the stockade, trying not to appear concerned. All I could see was Q. None of the other men were wearing a brand. That night, by flashlight, lying in my bunk, feeling confused and threatened, I wrote the letter Q in my war diary in pencil in case I had to erase it. My mates hung pinup girls or pictures of girlfriends and talked freely about sexual conquest and dates, perfumed letters from home, all of which I could see were great morale boosters. But I couldn't even be suspected of having the sexual feelings that came natural to me. The Q in my diary came to stand for my unspoken resentment and anger at a double standard.
Stephen C. Law. Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you so much. So nice to meet you.
Yeah, even if it's virtually, I have to say thank you so much for being here to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you so much for this, Mr. Stephen C. Law. Okay, let's just jump right in from the ground level, as I like to start. You are an ordained pastor. You are an author. Your current book is The Story of Bob. The Story of Bob, essentially a biography book that tells the life of Reverend Robert W. Wood, a World War II veteran, an ordained Christian minister, and an early gay rights advocate. When did you first become aware of Reverend Robert W. Wood? When did he first come to your attention?
About 20 years ago, and I was in a transition of sorts away from a commitment to pastoral ministry and preaching, particularly as a form of communication. And I was becoming aware more and more of how fiction and story explores the idea of spirituality in meaningful ways. And I was working with Mike Curtis, who's the senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly at the time, responsible for fiction in those pages for over 45 years. He was something of a genius, in my opinion. But I was learning a great deal about story and how stories work. And at that very time, I read in an article in the United Church of Christ newsletter that Robert Wood had lost his partner, Hugh Coulter, to death, and that he was living close enough by that I said to my beloved, Donald, with whom I had spent 45 bliss-filled years, I need to go and meet Reverend Wood as a pastor just to be with him at a time of devastation. That was my instinct. I didn't have any idea to write a book. So I called him out of the blue and said, told him who I was and asked him if he would like a visit. And he said, very much so, because he was living in a New England city, Concord, New Hampshire at the time. I don't think he had that large of a community. And he was broken, as people are when they have lost the love of their life. He was in that state of devastation and grief. And so when I went to visit him, I was present with him. Words really are inadequate at such a time. All words seem trite when you're listening to someone say to you that they've lost the love of their life and that they are either riddled with tears, sadness, grief, regret, all the things that they did not do that they could have done or should have done. And that was the way that conversation went that day. And I was just present with him. And I said, you know, I recognize that you love Hugh very much. I'm so sorry for your loss. And he asked me about myself at that time. And I told him that I was experimenting in a writer's group studying short fiction and that I was, you know, in a long-term relationship with my husband at the time, William Stroud, Donald is his name. And then he asked me if I'd be willing to consider his story. And I met with Mike in Boston because I didn't have a sense about it myself. Mike said, well, I've seen your writing. You can do this, but make no promises about publishing. That would be unethical and dishonest. But ask for 6 months to see if you can determine whether or not a story is there that merits your attention and time, and see where it leads. And that's what I did. So it was, you know, I went in as a pastor maybe and came out as a writer is how I like to think about it. But it took 6 years of my life after that. So take that in. When you commit to something like that, it's no small thing.
So, Reverend Robert W. Wood, he passed away in 2018 at the age of 95. Right. Researching this book, you just said it took 6 years out of your life to bring this book, The Story of Bob, to life. So what was the process like of researching this book and bringing it to life? What was that process like?
Well, first of all, I went to Bob and I asked him the question, or began to ask him the question in the weeks that followed. What moments in your weight, I mean, what moments in your life hold emotional weight? Now, Mark, if you could just think for a moment, flip through your own life history, you know that you can settle on those moments in your own life that are intensely emotional. And that was like the first round of questions. And once I got from Robert Wood, you know, this list, I then began to look at what he had on hand in terms of hard materials, what I call them. That means sermons, letters, journals of any sort, war diaries in his case, and anything that could be written and could be anchored in time and you could understand that that was true and verifiable, made your life a little easier. And so you just begin to recognize that there's a path forward with the development of a chronological landscape and an emotional landscape at the same time. And what you have to do, you can't trust memory. I don't even trust my own memory. So you have to sort of have as many verifiable sources as you can to weigh in on this story as it unfolds, to make sure that the truth of it is what is in front of you. And of course, Reverend Wood himself was reading the chapters all through the time of editing and so forth. Now, as I mentioned before, I was in a workshop format. I was beginning to bring early chapters to this group of writers and editors, and they were beginning to see problems right from the beginning, and that's what writers want. They don't want to, you know, see what they're doing well. They want to see how they're failing a project. In my case, there were competing voices because I started this in the third person, like a normal biography. So they found competing voices, and they also discovered in Bob Wood's case that
his internal life or his feelings were not present in a way that was satisfying for the narrative. That's true for many people that come from the Greatest Generation. They don't like to talk about feelings. They really don't. And even if, in his case, for instance, he was a hero in war on the front lines in battle for in service to this country, he did heroic things, but he couldn't talk about the feelings associated with that experience. He could often name the mortar rounds and the mortars themselves and the activity of being a soldier and unit cohesion and what was required of him in basic training and so forth, but he couldn't talk about feelings very much. So about the fourth year, I took what was a third-person narrative and turned it into a first-person narrative, which helped me to correct those two problems and made his, and where he could not articulate his feelings, I began to make them up as a point of fiction. And then I would take chapters to him and he would read them and he could see where the narrative would be calling for feelings. And when he would read those feelings, oftentimes he would begin to weep and he would tell me, you got it right. So I get the verification of his internal life, even though he could not name it for himself.
So during that process, what would you say jumped out at you the most? Were there aspects of his life that stood out to you more so than others?
That's a good question. It's interesting. I'm learning now more about what I might have wanted to perceive at those times and didn't, simply because it took almost 20 years for this to come to publication. So I'm reading it now with fresh eyes and fresh attention. And I'm asking myself the question, you know, what has been achieved in this story? And one of the great things that I think I'm recognizing is that, you know, Bob lived at a time in the 40s in a heteronormative culture, right? So, but it was a heteronormative culture that was insisting that being a homosexual was sinful. Being a homosexual was a mental illness. In fact, people were given lobotomies at the time to correct it. And anyone who explored the sexual proclivity could very well end up in jail and have a record for the rest of their life. So there are all sorts of ways that the time in which he lived was riddled with these pitfalls for him to even explore the idea of being a gay person. And what I think I did well in this book, and I'll let the readers decide, was to stay neutral and non-judgmental about his childhood and about his evolution into adulthood and in his war service, so that they can sort of figure out for themselves or see how it was that the way he came to understand desire just appeared out of nowhere almost in the Boy Scouts. And these early chapters, you think, why are you reading these things? This is a very predictable patterns of childhood. He's going to church. He has very loving parents. He has a wonderful home. But maybe readers will be wondering why they're reading that. Well, they're reading it to know that anyone who has that circumstance, it feels good to be in a place where you're loved. But it also is deterministic in a way. It's as if everything that you're feeling as love, as a child, is conditional upon your fitting in to a prescribed way of being, and that's heteronormative way of being. And when you begin to have these ideas, in his case, it was like in the Boy Scouts. He was around a campfire, and he had painted his face like all the boys had done, and they were doing this dance around a campfire. It's really a visual experience for me to write it and to read it. And he begins to notice a boy's body for the first time in a sensual way. And the boys had been given loincloths to wear as they did this dance. And he took this loincloth home from that experience and hid it in his drawer to protect himself from discovery. In other words, he was hiding something from the people that he loved. That's the irony. And he was using that then as a way of having fantasies, of gaining arousals, and coming into that experience. But that very experience is what separates him from what the readers will understand to be the protection of his own family. It's really kind of heartbreaking, because there's nothing in his family but love until this loincloth shows up. And then it's for him to decide what to do with that, and all the fantasies that he has attended to that, and others that he has in high school, and as he goes into college, other kinds of fantasies not acted on all the time, but they're all his alone to deal with. And it's particularly true in the military, when he's in military service. Now, he was from a military family, and this was after Pearl Harbor, so, you know, what are you going to do? Here's a great threat to our way of being, our freedom happening in the world. Are you going to be a part of the solution? And Reverend Wood was very much a part of that effort to stop Hitler, and would do it, you know, was willing to give his life to that end. But when he was in basic training, he was going across the, delivering a message, and he saw a stockade in which men were being held with cues written on their backs. Now, he saw that, of course, and saw himself in those men. And it was like an electric shock coming to him to say, don't show any sign that you have this inclination, because even your right to serve this country would be put in jeopardy if they should discover that this is your sexual orientation.
And when you say cue, they put that on their back?
Yeah.
To represent what, queer?
The word queer, exactly. And Bob, and the reason I know this is not, this was out of his hard material, not his memory. He had written the letter Q in pencil in his war diary in case he had to erase it. But it was there. And the memory, of course, was associated with that letter. And so it became vivid in our conversations, and stunningly so, because while he saw that reality and attributed it to himself, he was also asked to give the ultimate sacrifice on behalf of our country, which, to his credit, he did. I mean, he was a hero. You read the story of his life in combat, you realize he saved lives through his heroic action. He also was wounded in battle and left for dead on the battlefield, and spent 22 months recovering in a military hospital, all in the service of this country. And I think sometimes heteronormative people don't think that gay people can be heroic. Well, think again. We are heroic. We're capable of heroic deeds. In fact, the very fact that we live our life every day the way we do, with honor and integrity, is an act of courage, as far as I'm concerned, when gay people have to live, or GLBTQ people have to live within a heteronormative culture. We're constantly courageous by our very presence and by our very act of honoring our truth. I hope that's not overstated, but it's something I intensely feel.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, this is Claudia Barry, and you're listening to Mark Tara on Rainbow Country.
Stephen C. Law, we are here. We're talking about you. We're talking about your book, The Story of Bob. You are part of the LGBT community. For yourself, talk to me about when, for you, your same-sex desires and attraction started crystallizing for you. When did this start happening for you?
Well, I didn't know I was going to be talking about myself. I'm hardly worth it. But I would say that in seminary, there's some comparisons here to be made between my life and Reverend Woods in some ways, but my truth and his truth are completely separate. We can come back to that in a minute. But I was engaged in, I was married when I was 18. To a girl, same kind of situation in which I didn't think I was growing up in a culture that would prevent me to even acknowledge the fact that I had fantasies. And perhaps I'm bisexual. I do not know. I don't know the truth of it. I know that this woman and I, Sharon and I, fell in love at 18 years old, and we got married, and I thought I was being honorable in that. By the time I had finished college education and was in graduate school and had studied, existentialist philosophy and Kant, Immanuel Kant, and his moral imperative and what was required of people in terms of truth. And I was also studying the scriptures in new and varied ways from the historical critical method that I was learning in seminary by major biblical scholars. I wasn't thinking of them as literal. I was thinking of them as more metaphorical, more and more, and appropriately understood within the context of ancient communities as opposed to modern societies. But within those years in which I was having so much work to do related to thought and moral formation and all the rest, I came to a decision that this group of fantasies that was living within me were not going to go away, and that I needed to be honest with my wife about that. That was my first moment of truth. Then, in seminary community, I was no more supported than Robert Wood was when he was in his seminary community, and I really wanted to come back to that eventually. So all these moves I was making on my own, the same way Reverend Wood did, and a whole generation had passed. So
I took on the role of honoring or understanding that I brought a lie into our relationship. I sought some clarity about that through counseling. My dear wife and I divorced one another. And then I met the man of my dreams and life, William Donald Stroud. He was a physician working at Kodak at the time in Rochester. I was at Colgate Divinity School. And when we met, I wasn't really interested in forming any kind of relationship because I didn't even know what it meant. But the fact was I was meeting the man of my dreams right off the bat. And what I had to come to terms with was saying yes to that. And that was the best decision of my whole life, I can tell you. I'm a lucky man. And so by the time Donald and I found ourselves together and we were sharing that intimate partnership that was physical in nature as well as spiritual in nature, I just understood how the life of the spirit and the life of the body could come together in this rich and wonderful way with this particular human being. And I come back to that because when you are looking for the man of your dreams, I just got lucky. And so I'm not sure that there's a script for anybody, whether you're a heterosexual or from the LGBT community, for how it is that you discover the person that you're meant to be with in that long-term kind of commitment. I don't think a script exists. And coming back to Bob for a minute, there are a lot of details about his, you know, search for a relationship. And it took him into all sorts of different places and with different people. In the sadomasochistic world of Manhattan, particularly, is where he met Hugh Coulter. Now, I've never had anything like a sadomasochistic experience, but in order to write this book, I had to enter into that world non-judgmentally and be open to the many ways that that world lives and works. I find it fascinating, and I hope readers will stay open-minded to find it fascinating too, that people can be so alert to what their sexual needs are that they can put a handkerchief in one pocket and it will confer some message like I'm top, I'm bottom, I'm a master, I'm enslaved. I don't know what the vernacular these days are. But I know in Bob's case, it was a strange terrain for me to encounter, and I just tried to be truthful to Bob's story the best way I can. And I think that the readers will see that there's, you know, truth in all that, and that they might even think, so, no, if people are looking at gay practice and see that it took many people, for instance, in Bob's life as opposed to mine. I met my lover right off the bat, so I don't have that much experience with many men. A babe in the woods by comparison to even Reverend Wood, who had many different kinds of sexual relationships. And the thing that he waked up to after the fact, I think he thought in each one there was going to be a possibility. Could this be the one? And then you're left in the aftermath knowing that, no, there's disappointment there. That one wasn't the one. And how is this path going to unfold where he's going to meet you? But when you find yourself in a bar in Manhattan and they're meeting, the reader will know that love is coming into the room. I mean, not just sex. Sex is there too, but there's also love there and respect and regard. And suddenly, instead of not being together, they are going to each other's parents, introducing themselves, Hugh showing up in the parsonage, hanging drapes. It's just the way it all unfolds is very wonderful. And the way my life with Donald unfolded was very wonderful in a way. It was just different. And we supported each other as Bob and Hugh supported each other in our vocations over many, many years.
And why do you think Reverend Robert W. Wood, why do you think he was drawn to the S&M community?
Well, you know, I'm going to leave that for the psychologist to speculate about, but I will say this. I'll say that to me is not much different than being called into ministry. And here's why. When somebody comes back from war, And again, I have not been in combat, so I had to enter that world through the vicariously through the work I did with Bob. But what we ask our soldiers to do on our behalf, it's unbelievable. It truly is. I mean, there's and it may be different now. Again, I'm talking about war, Second World War, where you're looking at people that you're killing, and they're looking at you, and you're seeing your friends being exploded and losing their legs and arms on the battlefield. And you're experiencing all this death and destruction all around you, viscerally. It's not as if you're looking down from a satellite and you're dropping bombs on people you're not seeing, which is a different form of warfare. I'm sure it has its effect, but there's no questions asked when you read the story of Bob and his war life, that he comes back from a brutal, maybe what's happening in the Ukraine, it's compared. But you come back from that, you can't escape the destruction of it. So you ask these people who give their lives on the line for our countries to come back and take on a normal life. Well, what's normal after you've seen your friends exploded and after you almost killed yourself? I think only the psychologists that work with war vets understand this terrain, and I think in every veteran's case it's different. But I just came to really appreciate the sacrifices that people make on behalf of our country all around the world when people are asked to go to war. They do this, and it's remarkable. So you come back from that, and in Bob's case, one thing he had to keep him anchored in the world was the Psalms, which is a book in the Bible. It was one particular psalm that was meaningful for him, which he kept reading over and over and over for weeks. Like my grandson did when he broke up with his first girlfriend. And he went into his room and shut the door and played this sad song all afternoon. Well, Reverend Wood, to deal with this devastation, found this psalm. And, it has something to do with, if you believe in God on the Most High, I will protect you under my wings. I will give you comfort. I will not let destruction come to you. All these very positive thoughts in poetic form that he just kept reading and reading and reading, like a cycle of hope and loop and faith, that maybe that these dreams and these nightmares that he's having, this discomfort living in the world of coming back from the military, would ease, and he would find a purpose for his life, which he did in ministry. So you take that pain, and then you think, well, if you're receiving pain in sexual relationships, is that something then that can give you some sense of pleasure? I don't know. I just know that in the way I approached the subject, it seemed very tender. And Hugh himself was an expert with a bullwhip. He was a rodeo cowboy. And evidently, he was also an artist. And Bob was receptive to a sexual encounter that would allow a pain to be inflicted, but then sort of a nurturing of the wounds afterwards. Now, that's not explicitly stated in the book, and readers may be really uncomfortable with me about that, but I had to make a decision, because what happened was Bob and Hugh seemed to be forming a relationship that had a sacred aspect to it. I think the readers will see that when they see how their relationship unfold, the nature of their conversations, the nature of the way they showed up for one another in support in their work environments, the nature of the love expressed over 26 years, right? And then they're suddenly, they created for themselves even a sacred moment where they shared vows with one another. The world did not give them that privilege. The church did not give them that privilege. They claimed it for themselves. And it's a very touching moment in the book in which they just share vows with one another and make this commitment, which feels holy to me. It feels sacred to me. And so after they made that sacred kind of commitment, and I realized that sex for them was something different than sex for just the pleasure of experiencing tactile sensation and pleasure, I began to protect that in the writing as a sacred part of their bedroom that I didn't think deserved attention. So people do get a sense that that's what the nature of their relationship with. And Bob was really candid in giving those details. And I can say to anyone listening that if you're interested in those details, you can find them at the Congregational Library in Boston that holds the archives that Reverend Wood left to them when he died. And also all my note-taking is there as well. So if people have a curiosity about exploring the ways in which they explored sadomasochism as a married couple, they can do that. I just didn't think that it merited the pages of a book somehow. And I think Bob was in agreement with that decision.
Mm-hmm. So, Stephen, here, I just have a few minutes left with you. Here's my last question for you, and it's simply this. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've read, they've experienced the story of Bob? What do you hope your audiences come away with?
Well, I know that. I hope that they will always remember that we're still living in a heteronormative culture, first of all, and that that heteronormative culture and that living within it was always going to be requiring something of us as gay people, okay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered people. It's going to invite us to take out of the heteronormative traditions that exist that form morals, whatever we think we can take out of those, whether it be from churches or from psychologists or from literature. If it's coming from a heteronormative source, just remember that it's a heteronormative source. And if it doesn't include you, then your work is to take out of it what you can and make it fit your life. It also invites us to be very careful, very, very careful who we trust with making moral judgments about our experience. I hope that when you read the story of Bob, that you'll be less, more than ever, that you will not trust people outside of your experience to make moral determinations about what your experience means. I hope that you will pay attention to your inner experiences of the divine and outer experiences of the divine and claim those for yourself. And that most importantly, if you're in a place where you're feeling at all uncomfortable psychologically, that you remove yourself from it, whether it's the church, whether it's a school, whether it's a person that's supposed to be an instructor in your life, a guide in your life, that you feel a psychological uneasiness, that you take it upon yourself to remove yourself from that, gain some perspective on it, and then re-enter it. And I think if you're feeling your own moral formation or you're trying to think it through, claim it for yourself. We are moral people. GLBT people are quite moral. We are a heroic people. We are wonderful people in all ways. And, you know, don't ever give up on the idea of having the kinds of relationships that bring meaning to your life and make you the happiest person that you could be while you share this planet with others.
Stephen C. Law, well said, well done, well written. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
I'm so grateful for the opportunity to meet you and wish you all the best. Still singing, I felt rejected by that stranger, hurt emotionally. Pathetic, I thought to myself about myself. What I wore seemed to interest others, but the person underneath the clothes felt ignored. After another hour of smoke and grope, I left. All this titillation without a lover was frustrating me. Several weeks later, I returned to the Silver Dollar to find it closed, out of business. I called Frank Olson from a payphone. Which bar is it this week? Frank's network could literally open or shut down a bar. The arcade down in the Bowery, he said. Motorcycles were parked outside. I could barely read the tattered arcade sign over the door. Curtains prevented a view inside. Windows were broken in neighboring buildings. Vagrants slept in the doorways. I watched several drunks stumble along. One walked into the arcade and was promptly ushered out. I entered, ordered a beer, and leaned against a wall with one boot up. two men came in and sat at a bar in front of me. One wore jeans and a brown leather jacket with a fringe across the front and down the sleeves, and a cowboy hat tilted forward to the right. What a man, I thought. I watched him through the smoke. Our eyes met in a mirror over the bar. In a few minutes, he turned around and looked me over. I didn't move. He spread his leg. I inspected him. He appeared dusty. He stood up. He had to be 6 feet tall and thin. A red bandana hung out of his half-buttoned shirt. He took off his jacket and draped it on the stool by the bar. He walked toward me, and I felt myself becoming hard. My leg trembled. Please love me, I thought. He looked me in the eye and placed his left hand on the wall over my head, pressing his crotch into mine and spreading his armpit over my face. I noticed a sweat stain there, and I bit gently into the stain, tasted salt, and felt myself surrendering, wanting his next move. Suddenly, his lips were pressed against mine, and we kissed deep, wet kisses, ecstasy. You're one sexy cowboy, I said. You're a sexy blonde stud. What are we going to do about it, I asked. Not much tonight. I'm with a friend. He pointed to a short man sitting at the bar. He's from Canada. I brought him out on the town, and I feel responsible for getting him home safely. I was disappointed, but his concern for his friend's safety charmed me. What are we going to do? I asked again. I'm going to stand right here against you and make love to you, if you don't mind. Please do. I need that, I whispered. He pressed his knee into my crotch and kissed me with an intensity that took my breath away. His hot, wet mouth pressed on mine sent exhilarating sensations throughout my body. I felt as if we were the only two men in the bar.
That was my spotlight on the book, The Story of Bob. Available wherever you get your favorite books. For more information, simply visit thestoryofbob.com.
The phone rings. I got a message from the mayor. He's going to call me back the next day. I get the call, and he said, if you'd accept, we'd like to honor you with the key to the city. There was an event later that year in May. Just a key, right? Like, key to what? A decent job, a good singing career. It's really a metaphor, but it's history. So a reporter wants to talk to me and says, so it's a key, right? Like, what's the big deal? I said, well, not everybody gets the key. So I looked it up, and I guess it is kind of a big deal.
The date, May 17th, 2018, when trans activist Susan Gapka made history by becoming the first trans woman to be presented with the key to the city of Toronto. By the way, past recipients include Rush and the Raptors.
Hi, I'm singer-songwriter Steve Grand. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country. Song in My Head, Martha and the Muffins.
There's something in my heart that I need.
but now I'm blue. Oh yeah. When you put your arms around me and tell me that you care, I don't wanna be there. I was fine when you met me, but now I'm blue. Oh yeah. I never needed you to come along. You sing a different tune when I am gone. There's a song in my head going round and round, 'cause there's something in my heart that I never found. There's a song in my head going round and round, 'cause there's something in my heart that I never found.
I'm Dion Jones from Alpha, North Wales. You're listening to CFRC Radio in Kingston, Ontario.
Hi, this is Michael Anthony Alago, music executive, photographer, author, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is hour two of Rainbow Country, where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. So if you stay with me, if you stick with me, I hope you think I'm bringing you music worth hearing. Starting us off,